Forest Service researchers have released a final report on Black Hills logging, and the bill has come due. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, it's Friday, March 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, Seth Tupper brings you the latest on the new logging report. Then STPB's Richard Tubles joins us for a look at clinical trials in the Black Hills. These are designed to help Native Americans recover from COVID-19. A new survey suggests farmers might not be planting what the USDA expected them to plant. Kevin McNew with Farmers Business Network has the results of the survey and what it might mean. Laura Rohde introduces you to high school musicians expressing their grief and loss through music, plus sacred music for Christians' Holy Week. Maestro Delta Devagar is with us later in the hour. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With SDPB News, I'm John Nguyen. The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs has unanimously passed what's called the Respect Act. It stands for repealing existing substandard provisions encouraging conciliation with tribes. U.S. Senator Mike Rounds says the act repeals 11 archaic laws that discriminate against Native Americans. For example, laws that removed Native American children from their homes and placed in boarding schools to be taught Western civilization. Rounds is a sitting member on the Indian Affairs Committee. He says even though these laws are no longer enforced, it's time to acknowledge the historical injustices.
Throughout history, Native Americans have been subjected to federal laws that are offensive, immoral, and outright racist. In many cases, these laws are more than a century old and do nothing but continue the stigma of subjugation and paternalism from that time period. Clearly, there is no place in our legal code for such laws. The idea that these 11 laws in the Respect Act were ever considered is disturbing, but the fact that these laws remain in our books is at best an oversight.
In 1924, Congress enacted the Indian Citizenship Act, which granted citizenship and the right for First Peoples of North America to vote. The Respect Act is supported by the Great Plains Tribal Chairmen's Association and the National Congress of American Indians. The leader of the state Senate says a bill restricting transgender athletes from playing girls' sports should be rejected. That's because the group in charge of overseeing athletics in South Dakota already has a policy in place for transgender athletes. SDPB's Lee Strubinger has more.
On Monday, state lawmakers will determine the fate of Governor Kristi Noem's style and form veto of the legislation. Noem removed a portion of the bill that requires schools collect a written waiver from student athletes verifying their sex. She removed the ban on college athletes and another section that would create, in her words, a trial lawyer's dream. Republican State Senator Lee Schoenbeck says her partial veto takes out the worst parts of the bill that are bad for South Dakota, but
I still believe the bill should die because it's not needed. Our South Dakota High School Activities Association, which is our local school district, dealt with this at the local level 9 years ago. The governor had to deal with what was put on her desk, but the fact is that the train left the station 9 years ago, and for political reasons, they're making noise chasing it now.
In that nine-year span, one transgender girl has played on a girls' sports team. The policy recently rejected a transgender girl athlete because the South Dakota High School Activities Association determined the applicant would have a competitive advantage. Dan Swartos is the executive director of the association. He outlines how the current policy works. It starts with schools gathering documentation from the student who wants to play.
It's not a spur of the moment type decision that they're making, that the school's made accommodations, that they've seen a doctor, that they've seen a psychiatrist, and essentially that's legitimate. So they submit that to us, and then that goes off to an independent hearing officer, which is an attorney in Sioux Falls, who looks through it and weighs that against our policy and determines if they meet the standard or not.
If lawmakers reject Governor Noem's changes, they must approve the bill again with a two-thirds majority vote. If they fail to do that, the bill dies. Noem has said she might call a special session to take up the issue if lawmakers don't go along. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strubinger in Rapid City.
For weather today, we're seeing partly sunny skies in the northeast, mostly cloudy skies west and southeast with scattered showers in the west this afternoon. For SDPB News, I'm John Nguyen.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Forest Service researchers have released a final report on Black Hills logging. Seth Tupper has been following the story and joins us with an update from the Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in SDPB's Black Hills studio. Welcome, Seth. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
Give us a little bit of background. This goes back to wildfires and mountain pine beetles. Tell me a little bit about what led up to this report.
Yeah, so basically for the last couple of decades, we had a mountain pine beetle epidemic in the Black Hills that a lot of people know about that killed millions of trees. Also, we had a big run of wildfires. Some of the biggest wildfires in the recorded history of the Black Hills have happened in the last 20 years. And that has really changed the forest, according to Forest Service researchers. Obviously, there are a lot fewer trees, the trees that are there. Some of them are younger, obviously, because a lot of the older trees died. And so a few years ago, that led the Forest Service to undertake an inventory of trees in the Black Hills. And that's really like counting the trees. What they do is they go out and they look at dedicated plots and they do aerial surveys. And they basically extrapolate out and come up with an estimate of how many trees are there out there in the forest. And what they say is that that number is way down. And they've started this research, and they've issued a draft report last year and came out with the final report just recently in the last several days that says that, according to these researchers at the Rocky Mountain Research Station, that we need to reduce logging by at least half for the next several decades, or we risk running out of trees big enough to log.
You know, just as a side note, you spend a lot of time in the forest as you live and work here in the Black Hills. Do you notice this? Can the average person sort of see the forest change, or is this something that really, you know, the researchers can pull out in a way that's not obvious to the rest of us?
Well, you can notice it, and especially, you know, the Jasper Fire was the biggest fire in the history of the Black Hills. If you just go to Google Earth and look at the Black Hills, you'll see the scar still. It's a massive kind of moonscape of bare ground down there by the Jewel Cave area, which you can see quite plainly on the ground. And you can also see, you know, in areas where maybe trees died, you can see how quickly the forest regenerates. You can see a lot of young trees that grow up in big groups. You can see snags. I've been told that when you're out in the forest and you see a lot of trees that have snapped off about halfway up the trunk, a lot of times that was a pine beetle killed the tree and the wind came along and finished it off. And so you can see these things out there on the landscape if you're looking for it.
All right, so this report is going to set off a lot of consternation and debate. What are we hearing already about some of the fallout?
So basically, you got three parties in this debate: the logging industry, conservationists and environmentalists, and then you also have politicians who've come into it kind of late in the game. But on the side of the conservationists, Bob Burns is a member of the Norbeck Society, which is a local conservationist group here in the Black Hills, and he agrees with the report that came out.
We need to slow down timber sales, or else if we want to get the forest back to where we can have that full production like we have in the past.
So it's not over. If things are taken, measures are taken now, then, as you said, the forest regenerates and stuff. What else do you have for us today, and what's coming up next? What happens next?
Well, next we continue with the debate. There is a public webinar that the Forest Service has scheduled for April 7th to talk about this report. But what we've seen is on the side of the logging industry, they've engaged with the congressional delegation and the governor, who have all come out and sort of condemned the idea that we need to reduce logging in the Black Hills. And so that'll be a big debate going forward. One of the big things that'll be coming up is they need to write a new master plan on how to manage the forest for the next several decades. And part of that is determining how much logging should there be and how much should be allowed. And all of this information they've been gathering in these research reports and other information will be used to make that determination.
All right. We've also seen a sawmill close as well. Is that related to this?
It is. You know, the sawmill operators say that, the Forest Service has already been reducing the amount of logging they're allowing. The Forest Service people might say that's because of exactly what the research reports say, that you know, you go out there and the trees big enough for logging aren't as numerous as they once were. And we do have a bite from Ben Woodke, who is represents the logging industry. He's with the Black Hills Forest Products Association.
The recommended timber sale amounts would likely reduce forest products employment and companies in the Black Hills by 80 to 90%, and along with it, our ability to care for the forest.
All right, much more to come on this story as we always follow it closely. Seth Tupper, thanks so much for the update.
You're welcome.
We're going to stay in the Black Hills. Up next, Richard Tubbles is going to join us and talk about new clinical trials that help Native Americans deal with the symptoms and suffering of COVID-19. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Business and Community Development reporting on SDPB is supported by SDN Communications. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
In Louisville, a rapper-turned-politician is teaming up with the head of the city's orchestra to address equity and racial justice.
Even Teddy and I having a relationship is a threat to the status quo. Focusing on making the world better musically, but also educationally and politically.
I'm Ari Shapiro, an unlikely musical collaboration this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB. As we celebrate 1,000 shows on SDPB, In the Moment evolves to meet your needs. Beginning Monday, March 29th, the In the Moment team unwraps an updated version of the program. We'll hear from a wider range of people, focus on topics you've told us you appreciate, and shine a light on the place we call home. Listen to In the Moment with Lori Walsh middays and evenings beginning March 29th on SDPB Radio.
From the Big Sioux and Big Stone Lake to the Buttes and Badlands, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is bringing people together, creating events, telling stories, building community. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Listen for information about our Sound Vision campaign coming in April.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Black Hills Center for American Indian Health in Rapid City became an active clinical center recently. Their research focuses on alleviating symptoms of COVID-19 for Native Americans who tested positive for coronavirus within the past 10 days. Now, treatment and therapies are essential in preventing hospitalization and death for a population in South Dakota that is vulnerable. SDPB's Richard Tubbles joins us now to tell us about the clinical research trial and the unique leadership of the Black Hills Center for American Indian Health. Welcome back, Richard. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks, Lori. You know, the Black Hills Center for American Indian Health initially started in 1998. But what's interesting about this organization, Lori, in regards to what it does, is that its founder, Dr. Jeff Henderson, is a Native American enrolled in Sioux Tribe.
My Lakota name is Wowokia, which means the helper or the one who helps. So it's inherent in me and my perspective on life to look for ways that I can be helpful. So I'm frequently thinking about that. Last March, when this pandemic hit us, many of us felt compelled to try to do something to help mitigate, you know, the effects of this pandemic on us and our relatives, including our Lakota relatives that live out on the reservations here in western South Dakota.
Richard, what makes this research unique?
You know, I think what's interesting is the fact that they are looking for Native American volunteers who have been recently tested for positive for COVID-19. And, you know, currently we're at a situation where the vaccination process is on full rollout here in South Dakota. I believe you and I probably know a bunch of people who already have their second dose. But what makes this research unique is that it's on the treatment side of COVID-19, utilizing active 2 testing.
ACTIVE stands for Accelerating COVID Therapeutic Interventions and Vaccines. And what this means is this is the treatment side of trying to address this COVID pandemic, you know, not the prevention side. On the ACTIVE side, and with ACTIVE 2 specifically, ACTIVE 2 is the COVID treatment clinical trial program for those who are still outpatients, those who are not hospitalized.
That's so interesting, Richard. Okay, so we've got two sites, one here in Rapid City, one in Eagle Butte, which not only is doing the ACTIVE 2 studies, but is also conducting research on that prevention side. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Dr. Henderson, in another organization that he's a part of, is a principal investigator for the Novavax vaccine study. And he conducted that in Eagle Butte on the Cheyenne Sioux River Reservation.
We're fortunate to get the Eagle Butte site up and running. In fact, it's looking like it's extremely promising and extremely effective, possibly even more than the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, you know, which themselves are 94.5% for Moderna and 95% for Pfizer. I mean, most people were thinking, you know, that's way better than we ever thought it was going to be. None of the other COVID vaccines are likely to get up to that level, but it looks like Novavax is.
So I understand, Richard, that this organization has also other potential clinical research trials. Mm-hmm. Once COVID and coronavirus positives start declining, can they dedicate their time to other diseases?
Well, what's interesting is there's only a few sites that are on the clinical research side of treatment of COVID-19 for Native Americans. But, their role is pivotal in helping us for that. But, yeah, they have been doing academic-level research since 2001.
Though the U.S. is now doing a real good job on the vaccine front, there are still hundreds of millions of people yet to get a vaccine. Which means that we can expect people to continue to test positive, to get a new positive test all through 2021. Some of them, not all of them will never develop symptoms. Some of them will develop symptoms, ranging from mild to moderate. And potentially, if nothing's done, some will go on to develop severe COVID illness. It'll result in their hospitalization. It may result in their being put on a ventilator and being put at risk of losing their life.
So once this pandemic starts to get under control in the United States, I believe this organization has opportunities to really conduct research that will greatly affect the health and well-being of our First Peoples.
Good stuff. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Richard Tubles with this report. Thank you so much, Richard. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Coming up next, are farmers planting what the USDA expected them to plant? Kevin McNew is with us. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Health reporting on SDPB is supported by Monument Health.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear the latest from Omaha-born guitarist Dave Stryker, trombonist Clifton Anderson, saxophonist Joe Lovano, and the contemporary all-star group R plus R equals Now. Plus, there are classic tracks from Cannonball Adderley, vocalist Joe Williams, and pianist Errol Garner. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living, with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
Since 1985, Fresh Air has presented award-winning interviews covering a range of topics. Host Terry Gross has 50 years of experience hosting public radio programs and is regarded as one of the nation's most insightful, determined interviewers. She sets an atmosphere in which her guests volunteer answers rather than surrendering them. Join us on March 29th when Fresh Air with Terry Gross moves to weekdays at 2 p.m. Central, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Farmers Business Network is releasing a potentially market-moving farmer survey ahead of next week's USDA prospective planting report. With 1,850 respondents, this survey found that many farmers' plans are contradicting USDA expectations, and the implications for commodity prices and farmer decisions are significant. Kevin McNew is chief economist for Farmers Business Network, and he returns to In the Moment with an update. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back.
Before we start talking about the results of this survey, let's put things in perspective for people. Tell us what the USDA Prospective Planting Report is.
Yeah, as we head into the end of the month, March 31st, USDA will release their own survey of farmers across the country, asking them what they intend to plant this coming growing season. Now, this year in particular, farmers are facing just a really good marketing environment, growing environment. Prices are probably the best they've been in 6 or 7 years. You know, you and I have talked in the past year around trade wars and COVID and all the things that were kind of problematic for the agricultural sector. So this year, you know, farmers are rearing to get into the fields, and they find really, really good market conditions for doing so. And what we found is that, you know, farmers are maybe doing things that the USDA economists don't think, and maybe what some market analysts don't think. They're doing some kind of different rotations here.
Give us a little background about how the survey is conducted, the methodology of that, and then we'll talk about some of the key takeaways.
Sure. So, you know, first of all, USDA does their survey across a wide swath of farms across the U.S. FBN has over 20,000 farms in our network, and, you know, we're very fortunate that we have deep relationships with those farmers. And so, you know, we did our own poll early part of March, getting back responses, like you said, over 1,800 responses, 40 states covering 3.5 million acres. And, you know, kind of what our farmers said was kind of different depending on where they were. You know, in the Dakotas, North Dakota, South Dakota, last year was a very challenging year for planting. And so farmers weren't able to plant a lot of corn last year. And what they're telling us this year is they're going to come back really strong with corn acres and really ramp up production sharply there. So that was kind of one of the first major takeaways. We see big expansion in the Dakotas, big corn acres coming online in North Dakota and South Dakota both.
What's driving that decision for corn acres expansion?
Yeah, I mean, all the prices are strong, and you know, like I said, I mean, they could grow beans, and some farmers are going to choose to grow beans. But I think when it gets down to kind of the core level of a farm, a lot of farmers looked at several key elements of it. One is kind of what prices were in the late winter, early spring, that are established by crop insurance programs. And what they found is that, you know, while both prices for corn and beans and spring wheat were high compared to the last few years, the relative price of corn compared to, say, the yield of corn and that kind of stuff was just kind of a better play for them. So what we heard was a lot of farmers said, you know, I would rather grow $4 corn and have upside potential on yield, because they know that in a good weather year, corn can really pay off in terms of strong yields. Where beans, you know, you're not really going to get a lot of topside on soybean yields, even if you have good weather years. So I think that was kind of the takeaway, was that the soybean market didn't really give a lofty premium for growing soybeans, and most farmers kind of want to lean more towards corn because of that yield push, and you know, they can just they just like growing corn. It's an easier crop for them to handle.
So I want to talk about soybeans in a moment, but and what's new on that front. But one of my questions is the economic are the economic challenges of last year also driving? I mean, is corn kind of the sort of thing where you're like, we got to make up some, you know, we got to get some more money in the bank right now, and this is the year to do it? Does it also tie into how difficult last year was financially for many farmers and producers?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we saw last year, I mean, there was the weather impacts we saw.
Yeah.
Around the Dakotas, and so farmers, you know, you need a good early start to planting, and so when it was really wet last year, corn wasn't able to get planted, so they could actually switch to beans last year. So I think that was one factor, and you know, you're right. Last year, right around this time, COVID really hit full swing. The ethanol sector just really took a nosedive, and so and the other thing that goes into that is. Per acre costs for corn are a lot more expensive than other crops. And so I think farmers kind of scaled back last year pretty aggressively on corn because of all those various factors. And so I think this year with the returns much better, we are seeing ethanol return to close to normal. I won't say we're at normal, but you know, production levels for ethanol are inching closer and closer to normal. So I would expect by this summer, you know, the ethanol sector is probably humming along. You know, we'll see driving pick up. That's a really good season for ethanol sales with the U.S. consumer out on the road. So I do think things look a lot more favorable for the farmer that wants to plant corn this year.
All right, let's talk about news on the soybean front.
Yeah, on soybeans, you know, and this is where it gets really challenging because the soybean balance sheet, the amount of soybeans left at the end of the year is exceptionally tight. And so what USDA said in February, what market analysts have kind of been saying is, you know, we need about 90 million acres of soybeans just to kind of keep the soybean stocks or inventory level about where they were this year, which, like I said, is exceptionally tight. What we found from our survey is we don't think we're going to get to 90 million acres. So we think the acreage is going to fall short of that 90 million goal. And we think that sets up a really interesting price scenario in the next few months, because I think we're going to be very, very short of soybeans in the U.S. And that could lead to even more upside price potential on beans.
All right. So what's happening in China with the loss of hogs there, and how is that impacting U.S. markets potentially?
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the big catalysts for the last, oh, call it 6 to 9 months of prices just, you know, shooting up sharply is China. Mm-hmm. You know, we knew once they got the trade war issues kind of put behind them, they would be buying more U.S. commodities. But then add on to that, you know, they're really pushing aggressively to rebuild their hog herd. They're still not quite there yet, but their appetite, not only for soybeans, but also for corn, milo, even some wheat, has just really surpassed most people's expectations. So it's really kind of a just a great time, because China is just really aggressively buying a lot of commodities, and most of those commodities are being originated from the U.S., especially this time of year. So it's a really good time for market prices.
Yeah. What about other countries? What's happening in Europe and South America? How is that all sort of changing what farmers are deciding to plant?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You know, we work closely with farmers on marketing, and we remind them that, you know, prices probably won't stay here forever, because you're going to get not only, you know, kind of supply response in the U.S., where we do expect a large upswing in acreage this year. But you're also going to see, you know, Ukraine is another major competitor on the corn front. They're probably going to increase production. South America is wrapping up their soybean planting or their soybean harvesting season. Wasn't a particularly good crop. Is kind of mediocre. Argentina at the tail end of their harvest is not looking very good. So there were some chinks in the armor from South America this growing season. But you can pretty well expect that next year, you know, after farmers have harvested their grain and, you know, they're sitting by the fire in November, December, that farmers in South America will be growing what will likely be another bigger crop. So, you know, I think the message is demand is really strong right now. We see really strong prices. it's probably a good time to be thinking about, locking in not only this year's crop, but also 2022, because eventually, there'll be more supplies from other competitors as well as the U.S. to kind of dampen down prices.
Can you give us an idea of what the gap might be, from what, USDA has predicted to what we're seeing planted? Are there areas where it's just very stark?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest takeaway we had from our poll from our farmers was, we fall about 2.5 million acres shy of 90 million acres on soybeans. And that's a big number. That's a big difference when you're talking about razor thin carryout. We needed every one of those 90 million acres just to kind of keep stocks of soybeans in the U.S. about the same for next year. So, we're looking at a situation that gets really razor thin. In the Dakotas, they're not growing as many soybeans as somewhat might think because they're going to be growing more corn. That's a market that generally will ship its beans to China. So there could be more price improvements locally in say, North Dakota, even into South Dakota, where those beans traditionally get loaded onto rail cars and moved out to the Pacific Northwest for export to China. The other places we're seeing problems, I think, are probably going to be the Eastern Corn Belt, where farmers there were pretty much on the fence. They weren't really swayed one way or the other to grow more corn or beans. You have a lot of crushing, soybean crushing facilities kind of in Indiana, Ohio, that feed the livestock sector on the East Coast. And so I think there's going to be kind of a crimp on soybean supplies out there as well that could potentially have some local price impacts. So overall, I see pretty good prices for the next 6 or so months as farmers get to harvest. And I think locally, those areas I mentioned, I think the Dakotas could see some more price strength and again, the Eastern Corn Belt.
When we look at the impacts of last year, the impacts of the pandemic and the weather disruption that we saw, and the CARES Act funding, I guess what I'm trying to get at here is it a makeup year? Is it a time to be aggressive and start investing in growth and new equipment? What do we sort of expect, farmers in this area to be doing? What is it the time for?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it is exactly that. It's a time to, it's time to look closely at your operation, figure out, do I expand? Do I buy new equipment? These are the times that don't come along, but, once every 7 or 8 years where you want to be doing those investing strategies. So I do think farmers, want to look at technology. Obviously, one of the key ways that farmers try to reduce costs is by getting bigger. So, increasing more land value or increasing their land operation. Those are things that I think, are wise and prudent in this kind of, good economic environment.
Yeah, we were talking recently on the program about, drones in the fields and some of those precision agricultural investments that farmers in the state are looking into and learning how to do to sort of increase that yield and or, free up land for habitat or other things. I want to get back to what you mentioned about ethanol. And I'm wondering if a Biden administration changes the outlook for ethanol at all, or is it just more of the same?
I think by and large, it's more of the same. I mean, there's certainly some tinkering at the margin in terms of small refiner issues that I think Biden might be a little more favorable on in the past administration. I don't see a wholesale change in kind of ethanol policy as we move forward. So, but I also don't see a ton of upside here in terms of ethanol. So I think ethanol largely stays kind of where it's at today, which is, a blended fuel. It's used as drivers drive and at kind of the 10% level. But I don't see a ton of upside here for the ethanol sector because of kind of other broader things. And this has been going on for a while, the adoption of electrical vehicles and things like that. It's hard to see a world where we're at today that really sees an escalation in ethanol use either domestically or internationally.
Yeah. Anything I forgot to ask you about this update and some of these, predictions and the prospective planting report and what you're seeing from the survey? Anything else on the potential impact of that?
Well, no, I think we hit on key points. I think one thing we talked about at the end was investment strategies, and I think it's good to remind farmers that we have relatively cheap interest rates, and I do think we're at the tail end of the interest rate low here as the economy comes out. We're seeing inflation go up, and the Fed has kind of signaled that they're not going to worry about inflation at this point, but I do think energy price inflation, consumer inflation, I think that potentially has some implications for higher interest rates down the road. So farmers that are looking at investment strategies, look at that with the lens of interest rates could be fundamentally different, say in the next 6 months or a year.
Yeah, always great to spend time digging deep into this with Kevin McNew. He's chief economist with Farmers Business Network, and that USDA prospective planting report is due for release on March 31st. Kevin, thanks for coming back. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
For Christians, Sunday, March 28th marks Palm Sunday and the beginning of Holy Week. The Passion and the Cross is a journey back to the first century when Jesus of Nazareth walked the earth. It's a poignant and relatable work of art with original ballads and musical orchestrations that speak to contemporary life while honoring the original story. Showtimes for The Passion and the Cross at the Orpheum Theater in downtown Sioux Falls are at 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday at 4 p.m. Sunday. If you're headed to some of those events in the southeast, you should have mostly cloudy skies today with highs near 55. There's a 50% chance of rain to start the weekend tonight. You can join the Black Hills Bluegrass Association for the 17th annual March Unplugged Music Performance Showcase. That's Sunday from 2 to 7. It's a concert that presents some of the finest acoustic and bluegrass performers in the area. All musicians donate their time and talents. It's a fundraiser for the Black Hills Bluegrass Festival. It all takes place at On Common Ground in Rapid City, where sunny skies and 70 degrees is forecast for Sunday. It's a nice jump from today's mid-40s in the West. A sure sign of spring is the outdoor show. Partly sunny skies and highs in the mid-50s to lower 60s await those attending the Performance Radio Outdoor Show in Huron. Hours 10 to 5 Saturday, 11 to 3 on Sunday. It's at the Nordby Exhibit Hall on the South Dakota State Fairgrounds. And the City of Pier Recreation Department and the Oahe Family YMCA hosting an underwater Easter egg hunt for children 3 through 12 on Sunday. They'll start just after noon at the Pier Aquatic Center. And if your kids are 6 years old and younger, bring your swimsuit. They're going to need an adult in the water with them. We have more events online at sdpb.org. You can visit our community calendar. Happy spring, South Dakota. We'll hear more about the power of music during a pandemic up next. You are in the moment on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
This week on Science Friday, the connection between discrimination and mental health.
Parents' experiences of discrimination were associated with youth's mental health outcomes.
And there is a reason why your allergies are acting up so much.
In general, plants are starting to flower a lot earlier, and the amount of pollen in the air is going up quite a bit.
Join us on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
State House coverage provided by Boyce Law Firm, committed to our clients and building lasting relationships. A broad scope of services from personal injury to commercial disputes. Expertise you can rely on. Experience, integrity, community. BoyceLaw.com.
Beginning March 29th, weekday mornings on SDPB will sound a little different. Starting at 9, 8 Mountain with 2 hours of 1A, followed by On Point at 11, 10 Mountain. Then join the team from In the Moment as we cover stories about South Dakota told by the people from South Dakota. It's all your favorite shows, but at new times, starting March 29th on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Black Hills Information Security, a global IT company providing education, penetration testing, and defensive services, helping your company understand threats and building defenses, based in South Dakota. BHIS.co.
Arts, Literature, and Music reporting on SDPB is supported by the Northern State University School of Fine Arts. More information available at northern.edu.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Students' thoughts and emotions related to the pandemic and to racial tensions are being heard through art and music. A Sioux Falls High School choir director teamed up with a student artist and professional composer to create something unique. SDPB's Laura Rohde has this story.
We're really just kind of teaching life through music. You know, that's what art does. Art is a reflection of the culture around us. Music is a big piece of that art and reflection of culture.
Robin Starks Holcomb is the head choral director at Roosevelt High School. Shortly after in-person school resumed this fall, she saw a self-portrait painted during the isolating months of summer 2020 by choir member Shelby Wright. Wright references her self-portrait as her COVID journal.
I found myself looking through a lot of news articles and social media, and I was hearing a lot of stories and opinions of things that were happening in our harsh political climate, both politics and with the virus spreading around and deaths increasing. And I was beginning to realize how sort of uneducated I was about a lot of what was going on in our world. So I decided that I wanted to look more into what was happening. And the more that I tried to research and look into these stories, I just had this constant feeling of being overwhelmed because it was very abrasive between the left and right side. And being raised one way, but having friends the other way, you don't quite know where you want to stand. And being caught in the middle of that just made me feel really stressed. And that was the way that I could think to best illustrate my emotions and feelings at the moment.
After seeing how Wright expressed her feelings through art, Starks Holcomb was determined to give other choir members an artistic venue to express their pandemic experiences and emotions.
I thought, wait a minute, if that's how Shelby feels, I bet there's a lot of similar feelings in the room for her group, for her family, her choir family.
Starks Holcomb's idea was ambitious. It involves all 65 members of the concert choir and includes three artistic mediums. Concert choir members were asked to anonymously share their feelings and experiences through a written survey. Starks Holcomb commissioned Wright to use her peers' expressions as inspiration for a painting. The painting, along with students' responses, were then shared with composer Kyle Peterson to create music and lyrics for the concert choir to perform spring 2021.
And then I think as it came to fruition, and their words were turned into music, and they start singing and sharing the music, it's a tangible, you know, it's a tangible product. It's a tangible final outpouring of what they've been feeling for the past year. It's something they have actually put together, something that feels productive and feels like it makes a difference and feels like they're all together instead of separated.
Juniors and seniors make up the concert choir. Of the 12 choirs offered at Roosevelt High School, Concert Choir, directed by Starks Holcomb, is the top academic choir. And unlike years past, when students gathered daily to practice in their beloved choir room, They now gather in the school's enormous auditorium, spaced apart and wearing masks. Absorbing Shelby's painting and reading the pages of copy typed by these talented teen vocalists, Kyle Peterson says he was impressed.
They were so thoughtful, and so the depth and breadth of them was really extraordinary. They really poured their heart out into them. And there were some, so some of it was just the rawness of it. You know, they would talk about family difficulties and difficulties with mental health and with substance abuse and friendships failing and the new friendships coming and difficulty keeping up and struggling with relatives getting sick. So it was the breadth and the depth of the concern that was impactful. But then also their use of language, their turns of phrase. I'm convinced that several of the students in that class are going to be writers or poets.
I thrive off of human interaction, and I'm the type of person who goes crazy if I stay in my house for too long and I don't see other people. I lost a lot of myself the first few months and just felt really hollow. And as somebody who's usually pretty upbeat and full of emotion, I hated the helpless feeling of kind of just being meh and depressed, like, all the time. I thought the last year I kind of sounded like minor chords and just like really numbing and upsetting feelings all around. And I just, like, whenever I'm asked to kind of try to visualize what the past years looked like, I'd say it felt like or looked like a big, cold, dark, musty room or a burning building full of people. It depended on the day.
Peterson says being asked by Starks Holcomb to compose Choked Air was a responsibility he felt honored to carry.
It's a big deal to be invited in to a classroom of people that she cares for tremendously, right? I mean, she has unbelievable care and love for these students she works with.
And the fact their emotions, their words, their experiences inspired Choked Air is not lost on the students. Shelby Wright.
I got chills when I first was able to hear the sample of the piece. And I think that Kyle Peterson did an excellent job in portraying my peers' emotions and the theme and the feelings and the imagery and the painting. It's been super awesome, and it's really cool to start seeing it all come together.
Throughout this story, you have heard rehearsal clips of Choked Air. Roosevelt Concert Choir will perform the final piece this spring, spaced apart in a local church sanctuary, but united together as one through song. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Rohde.
As Christians across the world move through the Lenten season, the South Dakota Symphony Orchestra opens the door to sacred music with this weekend's concert performance. Joining us now for a preview, we welcome music director and conductor Delta David Geyer. Maestro Geyer, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori.
A few program notes for our listeners. The performance is Saturday, March 27th. That's at 7:30 at the Washington Pavilion, Sioux Falls, and in partnership with SDPB. The performance is available to watch live from the comfort of your home as well. You can stream it from the Symphony's website, on their Facebook page, or you can visit sd.net. Maestro Geyer, we were just listening to a wonderful story from journalist Laura Rohde about high school students sort of expressing their emotions from the pandemic and from racial upheaval in the United States through, you know, song with the help of their, you know, their teacher and a professional, you know, artist who is helping them do that. And let's talk about this weekend's performance and this notion of music, sacred music, Palm Sunday. There's a long history of using music to express some of the most human emotions, even if they are painful emotions of mourning as we move into Good Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this particular program has, like many of our programs, have gone gone through various iterations, various reprogramming initiatives because of the pandemic. I mean, originally this Palm Sunday weekend was supposed to have had Brahms Requiem with a large chorus and orchestra and all of that. And of course, exactly a year ago this weekend, we were supposed to have done Mozart's Requiem for Palm Sunday. So, and that had to be canceled. I think that was the first concert that we had to cancel last spring altogether. So how do you keep that honoring the weekend, the Lenten reflection period for which we have lots of music? You know, classical music came out of the church hundreds of years ago and developed as a result of it. But a lot of composers have written sacred music for worship, but also for personal reflection, as is the case with this piece, Haydn's Seven Last Words of Christ on the Cross.
Yeah. For non-Christians, let's put this in perspective. So Palm Sunday is the day Jesus of Nazareth really enters the city. It's the beginning of Holy Week. It's the beginning of his trial and his crucifixion. Christians use palms because it was said that people laid down palm branches in their coats and stuff for Jesus of Nazareth to walk or to ride through on a donkey or what have you. So it's a really important but also very somber and painful time for Christians as they think about those seven last expressions of Jesus. Tell me a little bit about the Mozart Grand Partita first, please.
Oh, the Grand Partita, again, it was a part of the reimagining. So one of the things that the pandemic and all of the reprogramming has allowed is for us to go to our musicians and say, what do you want to play? You know, like we have an opportunity to, and we have to downsize. And so this particular piece of music is for 12 wind instruments and a double bass. So normally we wouldn't program a piece like that. But it's a major work of Mozart. It's bigger than any of his symphonies that he composed, but it's for these 12 wind players and virtuosic and absolutely top shelf Mozart, but not often heard because we don't generally put that instrumentation on the stage. We'll fill out on the second half by putting an orchestra on the stage for the Haydn Seven Last Words, but this is an opportunity to honor our musicians and their desire to play this piece.
Yeah, tell me a little bit about Mozart's sort of imagining of this. What was the context of the time that it was written? How would it have first been heard?
Well, it's called a serenade. He wrote many serenades, which is generally serenades were lighter music and intended for chamber music in somebody's home or something like that. But he took the genre quite seriously and wrote several serenades that have a lot of substance to them, this one included. It's also indicative of his instrument, of his interest in wind instruments. So it presses the boundaries of the time for the writing for woodwinds. He had a very special relationship with the wind players in Prague. For whatever reason, the best wind players in the world at that time when Mozart was alive were not in Vienna where he was. They were in Prague. And he wrote a lot of music and pushed a lot of boundaries writing for those players. And we have a lot of fruit from that. Yeah.
Yeah. And more about the Haydn Seven Last Words. How does that unfold? Who are the musicians on the stage for that?
Well, so this piece exists in several different iterations. The original one was for orchestra. Then there was a version for string quartets. And then there was a version for solo piano. And then there was a version for chorus and orchestra with text added even beyond those seven utterances of Christ from the cross. We're doing a hybrid version of the orchestra and string quartet version. So there are several movements, one movement for each of those utterances for, Father, forgive them, what they do, it is finished, I thirst. Each of those utterances of Christ has a movement, a piece of music attached to it to express that. What's striking to me about this piece of music and all of these different movements attached to those words is how much happy music there is in this piece. You know, because it's a very sad thing, right? I mean, Christ is dying on the cross. But an example is, you know, the words, "It is finished." So there is a real weightiness at the beginning of the music, but then it opens up into this absolutely gorgeous major key, gentle music. So why would Haydn write this music to accompany that text? And the answer lies in Haydn's own his own faith, but also the church, the Catholic Church setting for which he composed the music, which, when Jesus uttered the words, "It is finished," it wasn't just that he was bowing his head and dying. It was that the entire salvation project of God was completed in this moment with Christ's death and resurrection from the cross. And that's the happy news, that that this is a means to a much greater end. And so Haydn was also trying to capture that more kind of cosmic element of the message of the text.
Wow. All right, so this performance, Saturday, March 27th at 7:30, it's at the Washington Pavilion in Sioux Falls with COVID precautions in place, and then also with that partnership with SDPB. You can enjoy this performance from the comfort of your home by streaming it from the Symphony's website, on the Symphony Facebook page, or via SD.net. Delta David Geyer, 30 seconds left. Do you want to say something about rehearsals or those, you know, pre-performance talks?
Well, as always, there's a pre-concert talk at 6:30. It comes with your ticket. There is an open dress rehearsal at 1 o'clock at the Pavilion. I think the tickets are $15 a piece, even more socially distanced. You can choose where you sit in the hall, all of that, if that's the way that you would like to do that. And finally, I would point out that there will be visuals for the Haydn as well. Like, I think we have 36 paintings of the Passion narrative from hundreds of years worth of history. That's great paintings from great artists that will be projected above the orchestra during the performance of the piece.
Remarkable. Delta David Geyer, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Lauren.